And this is Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Can you imagine Karl Marx living and working in Texas? Well, Marx at one point did consider moving to this country and to the Lone Star State in particular. And in fact, Marx was frequently fascinated by events and movements and discussions taking place in the U.S. Take slavery, for example. Marx detested slavery, and so he considered the Civil War, according to my guest Robin Blackburn, a decisive turning point in 19th century history. In many ways, Marx saw Abraham Lincoln as a positive figure. Marx even wrote a letter of congratulations on the occasion of Lincoln's re-election in 1864, a missive that Lincoln answered. A strong argument can be made as well that Marx's ideas influenced the culture and trajectory of radicalism in the U.S., but we are getting ahead of ourselves, which is easy to do because the book we'll discuss today, called An Unfinished Revolution, Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln, is packed with so many interesting and little-known facts. The book's author is Robin Blackburn, a radical scholar and writer who teaches history and sociology at the New School for Social Research and the University of Essex. When Robin Blackburn joined me to discuss his book, I brought up the fact that, for a decade, beginning in 1852, Marx regularly wrote for the New York Daily Tribune as its London correspondent. I asked Robin how Marx landed that prestigious gig and what kinds of things Marx wrote about.
I think Marx was hired because Dana, the editor and publisher of the Tribune, had visited Germany in the exciting period of the 1848 revolutions. And Marx at this time was editor of really the leading democratic and liberal journal of the time, the Neue Rheinische Zeitung. He was, of course, very much a person of the left, but socialism as an organized party didn't really exist in Germany. And Marx, his main role was, in fact, as a journalist in 1848 and not as an organizer or agitator, although his journalism was agitational very often. And I think Dana was impressed by Marx, met him personally in Frankfurt, and was quite delighted to hire, as reporter for his magazine, someone who would be known because of his pamphlets and other writings in 1848 in the Neue Rheinische Zeitung. He'd been known to lots of, including German Americans. It's not always known that Marx's famous essay on the 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, that was actually first published in German in a magazine in New York City. So this German dimension in American life was a very significant development, as there'd been a large immigration reaching sometimes hundreds of thousands each year, and it reached its peak really in the years after the defeat of the 1848 revolution. So there was this great influx, and these were people who were great readers of newspapers. So I think it was probably a fairly shrewd move to appoint Karl Marx to be the... I sort of see him, his role, as being almost akin to that of Thomas Friedman on today's New York Times. He was like a roving reporter and commentator. He wrote pretty long pieces. They'd often be a page or two pages. Of course, he wasn't writing about the United States. He was writing about developments in Europe and in the world as a whole, including resistance to European colonialism. He was a significant figure, Karl Marx, for readers of what was really one of the most liberal and influential newspapers of the time, namely the Tribune.
And just to expand on your comments about German immigration to the U.S., you write in your book that around 1848, the level of immigration was rising to new heights, and Germans comprised between a third and a half of all newcomers to the U.S. In the single year 1853, over a quarter of a million German immigrants arrived. How likely is it that Abraham Lincoln read Karl Marx's dispatches in the New York Daily Tribune?
Well, I think it's quite likely, because about 400 of these dispatches and articles were published, and we know that Lincoln read the Tribune, so extremely likely he would have been reading Marx. He wouldn't always have been aware of this, because many of the pieces were published, about 80 of them, I think, as editorials, unsigned. But all the rest were signed, so it's quite possible he was at some level aware. And we do know that his German-American radicalism was a significant force as far as not only Lincoln, but other Republicans were concerned. And they often tried to pitch their message and to try out their argument with German-American audiences. They were concerned to win away their support from other rival parties, the Democrats and the American Party and so forth. So it is significant that really quite a lot of these German radicals, they'd obviously fled because of the defeat of a democratic revolution. They were keenly interested in politics, and they sort of popularized a sort of secular radicalism, is how I would put it. And one can see the imprint of their ideas. They start debating topics like the need for an eight-hour day. They form workers' associations. They were keen on singing and music. And, of course, they helped to found breweries and were quite happy to sing their patriotic songs in beer gardens. And somehow the culture of these German Americans communicated itself and was a sort of factor in the evolution of Republican doctrine. And I think they helped the Republicans to see that really the danger of the slave power was paramount, and that causes like temperance, you know, banning the consumption of alcohol, that this was really a secondary concern, or really something best left to individuals to decide. The Germans certainly didn't regard the drink as the great demon, that they were much more concerned about slavery having nourished democratic ideals, and of course coming from a country where there was no slavery, they were quite shocked by it. I'm talking about the majority of Germans arriving, especially at this time. Some few Germans did, of course, go to Texas, and others went to other parts of the South. And but really, the great weight of the emigration was to the North. Marx himself, incidentally, had, even in the 1840s, he'd thought of emigrating himself to the United States.
Yeah, you write that he seriously considered at one point moving perhaps to Texas.
There was a group in Texas, yeah. There was a group of German Americans, and they were shocked by the slavery they found there. But it was serious enough that he actually applied to the mayor of his birthplace at Trier for an emigration certificate. You had to have an emigration certificate at this time. So he obviously, it was a serious plan, but he didn't follow it up.
We are going to talk a lot about slavery and abolitionism in the U.S., and you've been talking about the German-American influence on that movement. Let's focus on Abraham Lincoln while he was in the U.S. Congress. Now, at that time, he made a number of major speeches emphasizing the wrongs of slavery. How strong was Lincoln's opposition to slavery when he was in Congress?
I think it was quite strong and sincere, and it, in fact it does considerably antedate his arrival in Congress, which wasn't until 1848. But already when he was in the Assembly in Illinois, and earlier as a lawyer, he was concerned about the effects of slavery on American society. In one of his early lectures in 1837, he's concerned that slavery is really spreading disorder. There's a case of lynching of free blacks, and this shocks him. There's the actual murder of Elijah Lovejoy, who was an abolitionist editor, by an anti-abolitionist mob. That's something that he found very distressing. He thought respect for law and order ought to be the religion of Americans, he said, especially respect for the law. But he was also concerned, I shouldn't disguise that he was also worried about the tactics, which were sometimes provocative, of the anti-slavery people, the abolitionists. And he never actually became an abolitionist in the formal sense. He never joined an anti-slavery organization. He was a strong proponent of free labor, but he did find something very distressing about the whole slavery issue, which is that it was compromising the integrity of the union, and he thought it was a menace to the future of the United States, and it put a stain on it. He very much cherished the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, and I think he saw them as more important and more resonant than the compromises of the Constitution. He certainly, if there was a conflict, implicit conflict, between the principles of the Declaration and what was the practices of the Constitution, he would always back the principles.
How quickly did he want slavery abolished?
He spent a long time attached to a very unfortunate idea that it's a very grave wrong, slavery, but what we've got to do is to persuade the African-American enslaved and even the free African-Americans to return to Africa, or let's put it more accurately, to emigrate to Africa. Of course, the majority of African Americans had not been born in Africa. In fact, only quite a small minority by this time had been. But nevertheless, he persists in this view. It enables him to attack slavery quite strongly, but it did definitely compromise his position. Of course, African Americans were very unimpressed by it. And I think in effect, it greatly moderates the stand that he is taking. And he doesn't actually fully abandon it until the middle of the Civil War.
Robin Blackburn joins us on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. Robin is an historian and sociologist who teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York City and the University of Essex in the U.K. His two new books are The American Crucible, Slavery, Emancipation, and Human Rights, and the book we're focusing on today, An Unfinished Revolution, Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln, published by Verso. Now, I can, of course, guess the answer to this question, but it needs to be asked. Where did Karl Marx stand on slavery and the necessity of its abolition?
Well, he was really very strongly against slavery, and he saw the Republicans as the progressive pole of U.S. politics at this time. He wanted workers to organize separately in workers' associations, in effect trade unions. But for a time, he and some of his most influential followers were strong supporters of the Republican Party. They were drawn to that position essentially because they saw the Republicans as a party that was opposed to any expansion of slavery in the existing borders of the United States, and they thought it necessary to rally to support that opinion.
And it should be remembered, the Republican Party was founded by activists opposing slavery's expansion, correct?
That is correct. In fact, some of these German emigres, including people like August Willig and Joseph Weidemeyer, did play some role in trying to strengthen the Republican Party and to get German Americans to vote for it, and also to organize a civic militia as the Civil War tensions approached. And of course, when war eventually broke out, large numbers of German Americans actually signed up to the Union Army, and many of Marx's friends got senior positions in the Union Army, several generals and colonels. Joseph Weidemeyer, for example, was a colonel in St. Louis and played an important role in frustrating Confederate supporters in seizing St. Louis with its important arsenals and strategic position. So the German Americans, eventually about 200,000 of them, fought in the Union Army. Of those, 40,000 were fighting in units that actually had German as their language, that was spoken by the officers and men there. So that was an important strand. And I suppose there's a general democratic sentiment in mid-19th century that defines itself partly against monarchy, but also very much against slavery. And in the German case, implicitly critical of racial domination and supremacist institutions. When Weidemeyer organized a workers' union, he said anybody could belong to it, whatever their color, whatever their race, and whatever their gender. There was a sort of strand of civic egalitarianism appealing for rights for women, rights for African Americans. That was a very important part of the universalist creed of these German American radicals.
If Abraham Lincoln had a strong egalitarian streak, if he detested slavery, why did he not push for its outright and immediate abolition? What were the factors?
I think, in a sense, everything was contained within and defined by and to some extent limited by his overriding commitment to the United States as a new nation, a new experiment in republicanism, in self-government. He was aware that at the Constitutional Convention, a fateful compromise had been reached between the states of the North, where there was very little slavery, and the states of the South, where slavery was widespread. And he thought that both the compact of the Constitution and the compromises of 1820 and 1850, he thought they had to be respected. He was even willing to respect fugitive slave law of 1853. And he took up as his point of principle the question of slavery not expanding. I should say that in the first years of the Republican Party, and even up to really the Emancipation Proclamation in September of 1862, that actually Marx really was somewhat dubious about Lincoln and prone to be quite critical, as indeed were American abolitionists. And he very often cites Wendell Phillips or Garrison, their criticisms of how timid Lincoln is being. It was only once Lincoln took that fateful step of saying there needed to be an emancipation, which was then confirmed in the definitive proclamation in January 1863. It was only at this point that then Marx really lost all his doubts about Lincoln, and his comments about him are very warm in his private letters to his friend Engels from that point onwards. So he thought the great choice that confronted Lincoln was that either he'd see that the whole American experiment was going to founder unless it confronted this great wrong of slavery, or he thought it would not be possible to win the war and that the North wouldn't have, as it were, the moral high ground in the battle with the secession.
Robin Blackburn, you write that Marx saw the Civil War as a confrontation between two social regimes, one based on slavery and the other on free labor. Did Marx believe that the North really championed free labor, or that truly free labor was a possibility in a capitalist society?
Well, he was willing to call free labor wage labor, but he thought it was a quite inadequate form of labor, and that actually it would be much better if the wages system was abolished and private property and the control of private proprietors over access to employment. He was strongly opposed to all those. So, on the other hand, as we know, Lincoln was quite prepared as a lawyer to work for railroad corporations. And for him, free labor was an unalloyed good thing, and wage labor defined free labor. So Marx and Lincoln, I mean, I suppose what's united them there is that they did think that the status of the laborer, the condition of labor, was something incredibly important and helped to define the whole society. So they were in agreement on that. Marx's analysis, I think one of the things that's interesting about it is that he was perfectly aware that the North was not immediately committed to anti-slavery or general emancipation. He was quite well aware of how very limited the positions of the Republican Party and of Lincoln were on that topic. But he did believe in a sort of logic of the situation. He was a great one for studying underlying structures. And he thought that in the momentous conflict, either they wouldn't prevail, or if they did want to win, they would have to confront slavery and abolish it. Because otherwise, as he pointed out, the slaves would be, whether they wished it or not, they'd be working and supporting the Confederacy. If nothing was done to reach the slaves and to try and provide them with the possibility of joining the struggle, and to do that, what was needed was an Emancipation Proclamation. So he saw a logic of the situation driving the Northern Union towards emancipationism, whereas I think many other left and liberal figures in Europe, to begin with, they didn't really look at the social regime of the secession and of the north of the Union. They just thought that there was a case, and one can see why, because all the southern states did have congresses which did vote for secession. I mean, it wasn't all perfectly democratic, but it was as reasonably representative as it had ever been. And the fact that, of course, slaves were not invited to vote on this issue, well, African Americans didn't have the vote in quite a lot of places in the North as well as in the South. So, and they were overall in the South a large minority. So that didn't seem to completely rule out the validity of secession for many for many European liberals, including liberals with a capital L, people like John Gladstone, the leading English liberal, who was very sympathetic to begin with to the Confederacy. But Marx certainly didn't go along with that sort of thinking, and in fact he was quite contemptuous of it. And of course his judgment turned out to be correct, that the North would be drawn if its leadership was sufficiently courageous and bold, that they would see that the way to end the conflict, and really the only way to hasten its end, would be to issue the Emancipation Declaration.
And the book Robin is talking about is An Unfinished Revolution, Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln. Robin Blackburn is his name. The program is Against the Grain. Robin teaches at the New School for Social Research in New York and the University of Essex. He's an editor of New Left Review. His books include The Making of New World Slavery, The Overthrow of Colonial Slavery, and The American Crucible, Slavery, Emancipation, and Human Rights. And I'm delighted that he can join us by phone to discuss his book, An Unfinished Revolution. We have a link to that book published by Verso on our website, againstthegrain.org. So Marx believed, or he understood, that capitalist conditions would spur workers, would spur the working class into developing a kind of class consciousness and engaging in class struggle, and the outcome of that class struggle would be a new socialist or communist society.
Yes, he believed that there were great fundamental divisions in society, and that those who monopolized ownership of the great means of production, of the factories and the rail yards and railroads, he thought that they formed a class, a capitalist class, that would come into conflict with the employees, with the workers. And then he knew there was intermediate classes. There were farmers and there were small businessmen. He was concerned in the first place that workers should organize and that they should seek to overcome the weakness of competition between one worker and another by forming associations and unions, and by agitating for measures like the eight-hour day. I should say that Marx is, of course, one of the great founders of social thought and an important economic thinker. But he did feel that he was learning from the unfolding of events in the United States and from his own participation. He was secretary of the International Working Men's Association, which was formed in the midst of the war. Amongst its first acts was support and solidarity with the struggle in the North, and also trying to encourage workers in the North to form their own associations and unions. There are still quite a lot of unions have international in their name, largely because the IWA, of which Marx was secretary, was agitating for the founding of unions. Marx's great work, Capital, it's interesting, he actually was able to work on it in the 1860s in the midst of all these conflicts, and he seems to have changed his formulations. He has a very important chapter on the length of the working day and how important it is to limit that to the, you know, possibilities of the human frame. And he thinks even a modest reform like that actually is very important, because it would also put workers in a better position. They'd have more free time, they'd be better able to educate themselves and better able to organize. So he puts all that into the Das Kapital, which is actually published in its for the first time, the first volume in 1867, towards the end of the Civil War, when Lincoln wins re-election as president for a second term. The IWA Council asked Marx to draft an address congratulating Lincoln on his re-election. And so Marx composes quite a long and interesting address, saying that just as the Declaration of Independence was a fundamental event of the late 18th century, so the Emancipation Proclamation is going to be a great trumpet sounding a new call for the abolition of all slavery and rights to free labor in the 19th century. It's going to be a great historic turning point.
And how did Lincoln respond to Marx's letter of congratulation?
Well, it's interesting that in the first place that Lincoln did do so, because he was in receipt of literally tens of thousands of letters and messages of various sort, and had three secretaries whose job it was to, you know, bring to his attention the really important ones. Well, obviously, this address from the International Workers Association, which had participation of important British and French and German trade unions. So this was something that Lincoln did feel he had to respond to. And so he asked Charles Francis Adams, who was the then U.S. ambassador in London, he sent him instructions to write a cordial reply and to pass on a few thoughts. So this is a letter, it's only a page and a half long, but it does contain some substantive arguments, and in particular it concentrates on this fundamental importance of free labor. This was then published in all the leading newspapers, and I think it gave a certain prestige to the International in United States that right at the end of his life Lincoln had exchanged communications with the International, and the International soon had about 50 sections in North America, and about 5,000 to 8,000 sympathizers. There was quite a lot of radical ferment in the immediate aftermath during Reconstruction, and Marx's ideas fed into that, and the 8-hour day campaign came very much to the fore. They even won support in 8 states. There was legislation saying state officials should have a limit to their working day of 8 hours. And this became an important rallying cry in subsequent decades.
Robin Blackburn, historian, sociologist, professor, editor of New Left Review, author of An Unfinished Revolution, Karl Marx and Abraham Lincoln. We'll take a short music break and return with more of Robin Blackburn. Please stay with us.